Many species of fungus are not just harmless to humans, but essential to healthy ecosystems. Some are hazardous only to plants or to creatures that run cooler body temperatures than we do. But some have the potential to wreak havoc on human existence, and most experts agree our defenses are not where they need to be. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Humans can, of course, contract fungal infections, and especially if they are immunocompromised, those infections can be fatal. But there are many other ways an out-of-control fungus could wreck the world, not least by making it impossible to raise staple crops that keep 8 billion people fed. And those risks may be rising as the planet we live on grows warmer by the year. Author Emily Monison is a member of the Ronan Institute for Independent Scholarship and an adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her new book is called Blight, Fungi and the Coming Pandemic. Emily, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So, to be honest, I had not spent a whole lot of time thinking about fungi and their potential effect on my life because bacteria and viruses take up a lot of space in those conversations. I was alarmed to read in the introduction to your book that infectious fungi are the most devastating disease agents on the planet, and the fact that most of those diseases won't kill us does not make them less troubling.
Right, yeah. I think that scientists would say there are not many microbes that have actually driven species into extinction, except for fungi, which has driven dozens of frog species and our American chestnut tree into extinction or functional extinction. So yeah, that's pretty devastating.
Could fungi have played a role in the demise of the dinosaurs?
So that one, there's a hypothesis. This is by scientist Arturo Casadevall, who studies fungi and other microbes and lots of things. And he has a hypothesis that because fungi don't really like warmer mammalian temperatures, that when the big asteroid hit and there was there were reptiles and mammals that had survived, why did mammals become so successful compared to reptiles? And he thinks maybe it was because of the fungus that was there, because once everything died off, there was lots of dead stuff for fungus to feed on, and that's really what fungus likes. So there's a lot of fungi around. That it's possible that maybe the mammals did better during that period because fungi couldn't really infect them as easily as it could infect the reptiles and amphibians. So possibly.
To be fair, we actually rely on fungal species for survival, as do many other animals and plants. What are some of the things fungi do to serve a healthy environment?
So I think everybody agrees, fungus is really important it's important in wild ecosystems or in forests. It's important for agriculture. Fungi help plants absorb nutrients through their roots. It also is important for degrading dead things so that, every living thing locks up all sorts of important nutrients and sugars and all sorts of things, proteins, and fungi will break all that down and make it available again for other living things to feed off of. So they're really important basically in the cycle of life.
It seems like everything is being made different by climate change. How might climate change endanger our best defenses against fungal infections?
So there is a hypothesis. There's a fairly recently emerged fungus called Candida auris that infects humans. And it kind of emerged in the maybe 20, I don't know the exact years, but recently within the last decade or so. And so the question is, why did that emerge and why now? And the way it emerged suggests to scientists that maybe that's a fungus that was living in the environment, as most fungi do, probably almost all. And it wasn't impacting humans, but because it couldn't tolerate our temperatures, but that maybe as the, environments that it lived in warmed up, that it became able to tolerate warmer temperatures, including our body temperatures. And at that point, it was able to infect and live on humans.
And this thing is spreading not just among patients in a particular hospital, but it appears to be spreading between hospitals.
Yeah, so I'm not as, I'm not a physician or an epidemiologist, so I haven't been keeping up with what's been going on with Candida auris probably as much as I should, but I do know that it has been spreading. So there's a concern that, yeah, and especially pre-COVID, numbers of it weren't that high. Now numbers of Candida auris infections are higher, and yes, it's spreading to many more hospitals and to places, states where it hadn't been before.
And I won't belabor this point after this question, but this appears to be really good at like infiltrating spaces, right? There was someone who was infected in 2019 and we're at this hospital in Brooklyn. Like tiles had to be torn out of that room to get the place ready for another patient again.
Yeah, so the fungus seems to be able to, it's a yeast fungus, and so it's like a single cell. It's able to just get everywhere. And so that was one of the problems when it first emerged, is that I think healthcare workers didn't understand, no one really understood because it was new, you know, what would happen. And fungi don't usually do that. You don't usually get them on surfaces and, you know, all over a hospital room, or even probably on hospital workers' clothing or hands or whatever instruments. But this one did. And so once that was understood, I think the management of it's become better. But in that very beginning, yes, they didn't understand. And it was kind of shocking to find that they could, you know, think that they had sanitized a room only to find out that it was still there.
What role might antibiotics play in empowering fungal infections to take over?
So that's one of the very early on in the early parts of last century when antibiotics came onto the scene. Some had kind of called that, you know, the sort of age of fungal infections is really an antibiotic related thing. Because as I think a lot of people know now, that we have a microbiome, we have a community of microbes living in us and on us. Most of them are probably, you know, beneficial or not doing anything bad. A few of them are not great. And when you disturb that community, that allows sort of opportunistic microbe to take over, whether it's a bacteria or a fungi. And in this case, if you're taking antibiotics and you sort of, you know, alter that community, there's the potential for some fungi that's living within you to overgrow and cause an infection.
I realize this is probably an annoying question, but like, they're not plants, they're not animals. Are they closer to one or the other?
Yeah, they're closer to animals than they are to plants. So people used to think that they were plants just because they look like plants and they kind of grow like plants, but they are evolutionarily more closely related to, or phylogenetically sort of evolutionary related to animals. And we have share the same kind of basic cell. So our cells are called eukaryotic cells, which kind of just means we have cells that have lots of little organelles, little organs in a nucleus that's enclosed, and fungi do too. And that's not true of bacteria.
So you mentioned frog extinctions earlier. What do we know about how fungi might have played a role in the disappearance of frog populations in a lot of places, right? Australia, the US, Canada, and also Costa Rica.
Yeah, all around the world. So that was something that started happening in, I think, the late 1980s, early 1990s, that the frogs were disappearing. I think a lot of people my age, my early 60s, you know, heard about that and nobody knew why. Was it toxics? Was it a virus? Was it, you know, what was causing this? And it turns out that one of the things that was contributing to that in a large part, causing it in many of these places, was a fungus called a chytrid fungus, which is an aquatic fungus. So it likes to be in the water. And was subsequently found that through some studies of frogs that had died in a museum, they took those frogs, they tried to culture what was on the frogs, and they eventually found this chytrid fungus. And soon enough, they were able to find that fungus wherever populations of frogs were dying. And so they could link the chytrid fungus to the frog die-offs. So that is, you know, one of the examples of sort of the most catastrophic global fungal pandemic, I think.
Yeah, this was so interesting to me. I guess a frog skin is a miracle of biology in many ways, but one trade-off is that it's pretty vulnerable to fungal infection.
Yeah, in this case, it has what the fungus wants to consume. And also, just because frogs do so much, there's a lot of respiration. That's kind of how they live in the environment, is through their skin. And so, when the fungus is infecting their skin, it's very vulnerable. I can't speak to the details really of what actually happens, but the fungus does get in, you know, and also it kind of leaves their skin in tatters, and it also can cause, they eventually, because they can't really regulate that what's coming in and coming and going through their skin as much as they normally would. Mm-hmm. So once they're infected, the electrolytes can get kind of thrown off balance. And I believe they kind of die of sort of the equivalent of sort of like a heart attack.
How does it happen that infections among captive, like pet animals, end up in wild areas or wilderness areas before very long?
So that, it seems that there are, so anytime an animal is traded or moved around or taken, especially if it's taken from the wild, it has the potential to carry its own, it has its own microbiome. And with that, it has the potential to carry a fungus from its homeland to someplace else. How does it get out is when people think that they're doing a good thing, maybe that they have pet animals and they grow too big for their tank or the cage or crate or whatever. And so, you know, maybe they live in a place where they think that frog can also live. So they release it into the wild. So that's one way that there's the potential for pet animals to carry disease into the wild. There are also, there's the potential for escapees. You know, they're not intentionally released, but they can escape. And so that is believed to be one of the ways that this can happen.
And then they get out, and these pathogens they might be carrying that wouldn't harm any other animal had they stayed home in a tank or whatever, they're exposing animals that have no natural defenses.
Right. So they have natural defenses, but not to that fungi.
Yeah.
So yes. And yeah, so that's what happens, that that fungus probably evolved, co-evolved with its host in some other place, because they've probably been, you know, kind of at each other for however long. And so they kind of came to an uneasy peace. The pathogen infects the animal, but the animal doesn't die. But when it comes and finds a new host that has never seen that pathogen or that fungus before, it really doesn't have any, you know, defense for that particular pathogen.
So I know there's a robust trade in animals that are not supposed to cross national borders, but what about the ones that are legally imported and exported? Are they tested for these kinds of infections?
Yeah, so that was something really interesting that I found a hard, it was kind of hard to believe when people were telling me this, scientists and people involved in the trade, is that there's really not a whole lot of inspection for disease in traded animals like amphibians and reptiles and those sorts of animals. So animals that are, it's very different for animals that are traded for food, and also for some fish species that are considered really important species in our country, like salmonids, salmon, trout. But for a lot of the other animals, there's not really a real dedicated or ability to inspect every animal or requirement to ensure that all those animals have absolutely no disease. So there's the potential for a lot of diseases to slip through in the animal trade as it is.
So is the recommendation that people don't take these animals into their homes as pets?
I don't know. You know, so I spoke to some scientists who would say that's the answer. And then I spoke to some people who said, well, that's really, you know, not an answer. The answer is to be more aware and more careful, because by bringing some of these animals into our homes, we people, I think there's a quote by some famous conservation scientist that, you know, by getting to know these animals, we also want to protect them. Hmm. So, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I think you can find both extremes.
All right, Emily, let's talk about rust, not the kind that ruins your tools, but the shape-shifting spores that can infect plants. These are scary, but I have to tell you, they're also fascinating. A lot of them require two different hosts, right? Two different organisms to complete their life cycle?
Yeah, yeah. They are really fascinating, and two very different hosts. So like, well, plants. So I wrote, these typically occur in plants or do occur in plants. And so I wrote about a couple that infect trees. And then their alternative host are like berry bushes. So very different kinds of species that they need to complete their life cycle, as you say. And they also can have, so, you know, fungi produce spores. That's an important part of their life cycle. And in the case of these rusts, some of them can produce five different kinds of spores, which is just bizarre. And really interesting.
So what sort of defenses do trees and plants have against rust infections? Like if an immune system is working properly in a plant or a tree, what happens?
So plants do have some kinds of immune defenses, like in the food that we eat. These tend to be sort of the bitter kinds of chemicals that make bitter tastes. Trees produce also different kinds of chemicals that help protect them against invasive microbes and that sort of thing. And then trees also have this kind of ability to sort of wall off an infected area. So like when you sometimes see those blobs and burls on trees, what you're seeing is a tree that's sort of walled off some kind of infection and just grows over it. So, which is why you can see these amazing trees in the woods sometimes that look like, you know, the centers or parts of them are kind of hollowed out, but they still look strong and are growing. So they've fought off an infection successfully.
So what's happening with rust now and white pine trees?
Oh, so that's an interesting story. So there's a disease called white pine blister rust, which infects pine trees that are called five needle pine trees. So here in the East Coast, we have white pine trees, and those were infected with rust at the turn of last century, so around the 1900s. And that's a disease that it's a rust that bounced back and forth between these pine trees and the ribes, currants or gooseberry bushes. And so there was a big effort back then, and it would kill the pine trees, and pine trees are an important part of the lumber industry, and they're just an important part of our environment here in the East. And so there was an effort to get rid of the intermediate host or the ribes. And so there was a big effort back in the 30s and 40s to pull these bushes, and it was fairly successful. And so we have some big, beautiful white pines here. It also infected the West. So it was, and these infections happened through plants that were traded. They came from Europe, and then they came here, and then they gave the rust fungi a lift from Europe to here. And so the same thing happened on the West Coast. And there are several other kinds of white five needle pine trees. And one of them is called the white bark pine. And that's the one that I wrote about, because that is a pine tree that it really wasn't an important lumber industry tree, but it's a really iconic pine that tends to grow in the mountains near tree line. It's got a really cool relationship with one particular bird that sort of plants its seeds. And so it's really an amazing tree. And that tree is currently being impacted not only by white pine blister rust, but other problems like climate change and I think beetles. I can't remember. But, you know, these are trees that are potentially endangered. And it's a similar story, only there. Back in the early part of last century, they tried to remove a lot of the intermediate hosts, those ribes, but it's a much more rugged landscape, and they weren't able to do that as well as here in the East.
Hardly anybody alive remembers this firsthand, but North America saw an astonishing loss of species in the form of chestnut blight. How did that happen?
Yeah, so again, it's these. Both of these happened around the same time, the pine blister rust and the chestnut blight. So this again happened around the turn of last century. Chestnuts were a really important part of the forests along the Appalachian Range in the East. And there was also trade for chestnuts from other countries like China and Japan. People would grow these, you know, Asian chestnuts too. And so at some point, one of those saplings probably came over infected with what's called chestnut blight, Cryphonectria parasitica, I think, a fungus. And so that fungus took hold, and the first place it was noticed was in the Bronx Zoo. And there was a forester there. They, back then, you know, they made the Bronx Zoo, and it was in a place where there were lots of old trees, and the developers of the zoo thought those trees were actually more important than the animals, because, you know, trees that are hundreds of years old are just irreplaceable. And so they had a forester taking care of them. And one year he noticed, you know, some of the trees seemed to be infected with something, but it wasn't too bad. And he thought maybe it's a fungus, but the next year they would be fine. And the next year thousands of trees were all infected with this fungus. It was eventually identified as a fungus called Cryphonectria parasitica, and it was eventually identified as a fungus that had probably originated in, I think, China or Japan. It was found in trees in China, again, turn of last century, but not killing those trees. So, like we talked about before, it probably involved a relationship where it infected those trees, the chestnut trees in China, but it didn't kill them. When it came here, it just utterly destroyed all of the chestnuts in the east. And we still have chestnuts. You can go hiking and see these shrubby little chestnuts because the roots still grow. And so these trees died, but they'll try to resprout, and you'll see these sad little 10-year-old chestnut trees that they'll grow, they'll get, a few inches around, and then they'll just die from the blight.
It's just amazing how quickly that happened.
Yeah, it was within a few decades. It just kind of raced down the coast, and probably I don't know really the explanation. I think part of it is that there were so many chestnuts, and also that this was a fungus, and the spores were just blown and carried and easily transported from tree to tree. And it was just so destructive.
So in 1912, Congress passed this thing called the Plant Quarantine Act. What was the purpose of that, and how effective was it?
So I will say right up front, I find regulation really difficult and complicated. So I'm going to do my
Broad
best to
strokes
give
is
it to you.
fine.
A little bit of history about that is just because it was an interesting history. It was a time again. So I mentioned two different times where, trees were being imported and brought in from far away. And so around the turn of last century, again, 1900s, there was a program by the USDA to bring all sorts of plants from all over the place so that we could kind of get an edge on agriculture, and also ornamental plants were brought in. So there was one guy who was in charge of that program, and his job was to bring in as many plants as he could. And his friend had an opposite view, who also worked at the USDA. His friend was, I think he was an entomologist, he was trained entomologist, and he knew about all the problems that pests could cause and also pathogens like fungus. And so at some point, the two of them kind of came to a head because you've got one USDA guy who wants to bring in all sorts of exotic and interesting plants and good to eat foods, and another who's saying the more things we bring in, the more disease we're bringing in. And we've already seen this. We've seen it in the pine trees, we've seen it in the chestnut trees. And then there's another story about the cherry trees that are in Washington, D.C. that were brought in as a gift from Japan. And the first time all of those cherry trees were brought in, those that looked for diseases and pathogens looked at the trees that were imported and said, "We can't plant these. They have pathogens on them." So they were destroyed too. It was like a to-do because they were sort of didn't want to insult a gift. But I can't remember where in Japan they came from, but they actually sent more trees the next year that were very good to plant and didn't have any diseases. And so all of that kind of enabled I'm blanking on his name. I think it's Charles Marlatt. No, sorry. Anyway, I can't remember his name. But he really pushed for regulation. He had lots of information by then about the problems that disease could cause. He pushed in Congress to have some kind of regulations on imported plants. He said, other countries don't let plants in like we do. And so we've become the dumping ground for lots of, potential pathogens. And so that a regulation came into place where I believe eventually some imported plants were quarantined. Eventually plants could not come in with any soil attached to their roots because a lot of these organisms would be in the soil. And so there's just more regulation and consideration of the plants that are coming into our country. I think that if you look at over the decades, that probably saved a lot of pathogens from coming into the country, but plenty of pathogens, including insect pests and things like fungus, have come in over the decades, even so. And now we actually have a national mycologist, and her job, she works in DC, she's part of the USDA, and I think, and her job is to look at when plants do come into the ports, There are I plant people that look at the plants to see if there's any obvious signs of disease. And if they do see anything, they try to identify what it is. If they can't identify what it is, they send it to her, and her job is to look at it and identify and see whether it's a dangerous or potentially dangerous pathogen. So there, you know, there's much greater awareness and effort to keep out plant diseases, and much more so than there is to keep out animal diseases. But, you know, you can imagine, as much as you look, it's like looking for a tick on the dog. You're always going to miss something.
Yeah, and stories like these are so interesting because, especially before people really understood this, you know, like the idea that it was so beautiful to bring in plant species from all over the world, and wouldn't it be lovely to populate a garden with these? We just didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't know, and we still love, I garden. I love a beautiful, interesting plant or flower, and I'm just hoping that what I plant in the garden comes from a place that has considered, or, you know, been careful about the hygiene of those plants. There is actually an effort that I wrote about that's just starting, kind of getting started, which is to have sort of a inspection label for plants that are in plant nurseries that we buy, that say these have been inspected for disease and they're, you know, clean. So things are slowly changing.
All right, let's talk, Emily, about bananas. Most of us know the ubiquitous identical yellow fruits known as the Cavendish banana. Before the Cavendish, the world loved the Gros Michel, which I'm told was like vastly better than current bananas. How were the Gros Michel bananas lost forever?
So the Gros Michel bananas were grown in huge plantations because bananas were a really big deal for the first half of last century. They still are. And a fungus that came, I can't remember where it was, where it originated, but in bananas that have evolved a relationship to be able to live with that fungus. But that fungus eventually came into the plantations, and it was called, it's a fusarium fungus. It was called, right now it's called TR1 for just the strain that it is, but it completely destroyed the Gros Michel bananas. And it's a fungus that once it infects the plants, it's a soil-borne fungus, and so it's in the soil. So what happened was that when that fungus came along and started killing off the banana trees, which are actually herbs, so they're not really trees, but killed off the banana trees, it got into the soil. And so the plantations, once they became infected, would just sort of leave that plantation behind and grow in a new place, which is a pretty unsustainable way to, you know, grow large crops like that. So eventually they realized that they weren't going to be able to grow those bananas anymore. And it was that fungus is thought to be transported by plants that were taken from one place to another by soil. So anytime workers were walking around with soil in their boots from one plantation to another, machinery, tractors that would have soil. So it was very easily transported from one place to another, and which is how it's believed to have gotten to be everywhere that Gros Michel was growing. So what they had to do was try to replace that banana with another banana. And it turns out, fortunately, that there was another banana called the Cavendish, which is what we all eat now, that was resistant to that strain of that fusarium fungus called TR1. And so they just, you know, instead of thinking about why all those, I mean, maybe they thought about it, I don't really know, but, you know, they replaced, you know, they had a problem with how they were growing all these bananas in huge plantations, and one fungus could come and wipe out that plantation. And then they planted a different kind of banana called the Cavendish in a similar way. So they started growing Cavendish bananas in these huge plantations as a monocrop. And bananas are clones. They're pretty much clones. So there's very little genetic diversity. So there's not a banana that's going to be able to escape that fungus once it infects a plantation. So now what's happened in the last couple of decades is a different kind of fusarium fungus called TR4 is infecting bananas. And so there's a big concern that what happened to the Gros Michel will happen to the Cavendish banana.
What can we do about that?
Well, one thing that some of the scientists I spoke to suggest is that, you know, there's lots of different kinds of bananas. Maybe we all could get used to eating different kinds of bananas, and then they wouldn't be growing these huge monocrops of a banana like the Cavendish. There are other attempts to try to develop bananas that are resistant to the fungus so that they can plant, you know, the same kind of Cavendish tasting, Cavendish looking banana, but that it will resist the fungus. So right now, but that's really kind of the two main options right now.
So it could be that, you know, 50 years from now, people don't eat the Cavendish banana. There's something else that's on every supermarket shelf.
Yeah, there could be something like that. Or there could be something like maybe a Cavendish banana that's been genetically edited, if that ends up being the solution and is accepted. So yeah, or both. I mean, that's one of the things. So for all of these things, there's just, you know, we always want one answer or one solution, but sometimes maybe if there's a couple of different solutions, we would probably be better off.
White nose syndrome, Emily, is such a scary disease, at least for bats and for the people who care about bats. What does this fungus do to little bat bodies?
So this is a fungus that grows, so it's called white nose, and that was originally because when scientists first saw dead and dying bats outside their caves, it had a little puff of this fungus on their nose. But really the problem is that this fungus also infects the bat's wings. And when some of the images that I've seen of the bat wings, they kind of look like moth hold sweaters. It's just, you know, heartbreaking to see these wings that are just full of holes. And what scientists think is actually the mechanism, this, they don't really know exactly how this fungus is killing off bats. But what they think is that it's causing them to rouse more during hibernation. So this impacts hibernating bats, which in our, here in the Northeast, we have little brown bats that hibernate. So these are bats that go into the caves in the winter. And when they do go into their caves, they're really kind of treading a really thin metabolic line. They go in with just enough fat to get them through the winter. So the more they wake up, they burn a little fat. And they think that one of the problems is that this fungus is causing them to rouse more during their hibernation. And so they're just really depleted by the spring and they can't survive. So that's what the current hypothesis is, I think, that for how exactly these bats are dying from this white nose fungus.
What's ironic is that bats are remarkably good at fighting off other kinds of pathogens that harm other species, right? Like that's one reason that bats are like a vector of disease.
Yeah, like viruses. I think nobody, I'm not sure, I don't really know the science of why they're good at fending off viruses. But in this case, it's more that the fungus seems to be infecting and growing on them when they are hibernating. And when they're hibernating, everything is slowed down. Their metabolism slowed down, breathing slowed down, and their immune system is probably also not, is definitely not working at, you know, its peak performance. And so that provides the fungus with an opportunity to grow. Once they come out of hibernation, they're pretty good at beating off that fungus. So they will, and part of it is probably their bodies warm up. So the fungus probably doesn't like the warm bodies, but also their immune system can kick in and get rid of the fungus.
How have humans inadvertently contributed to the spread of this?
So this is one where nobody, again, this one has been found in bats and in bat caves in Europe, Eurasia, and nobody exactly knows. You know, the way that they trace where a fungus comes from is similar to like just thinking about COVID, all that DNA analysis and genetic sequencing sort of traced back where something came from. And so what they found is that the ancestors, you know, this fungus has also been in bats that are in Europe, and it was there, I think, 100 years ago. So it's been there a while and probably much longer. Those bats don't seem to die from the disease again. So they've come to some sort of, you know, they can live with the fungus. And they think that maybe somebody, a caver or somebody who was in those caves in Europe and then came over here, might have picked up that, you know, some spores or little bits of fungus that were in the mud on the floor of the cave, came over here, went caving, and might have inadvertently dropped some of that fungus here. And I think the current thinking is that it probably wasn't just a one-time event. It might have happened again and again and again, and eventually at some point, it just took off.
There are scientists racing to find a solution to this before we lose more bats. Tell us about the fat bat study.
Yeah, so there's a study that found that, you know, I mentioned that they're just living on this sort of metabolic thread, that they have just enough to get them through the winter. And so there's a study that showed the bats that were heavier going into hibernation managed to survive white nose better than those that were had less weight on them. And another study around the same time also looked at the genetics of those bats that were surviving white nose, because there are increasingly some survivors to white nose. So the question is, you know, what advantage do they have and why are they surviving or how are they surviving? And so the current thinking is that maybe that there's some reason, whether it's genetic or behavioral, that bats that might be able to put on more weight before hibernation might make it through the winter better. Even if they're roused more by the fungus. And then when they you know, spring comes, they have enough left to sort of overcome the fungus and still get out and thrive.
We should let people know there are lots of hopeful notes in this book that otherwise might sound depressing. Talk about this effort to resurrect chestnut trees. How are scientists trying to do that?
Yeah, so that's a really, I love that story just because it involves so many people, a lot of volunteers, a lot of scientists. And that's something that, so as soon as the chestnuts had sort of been destroyed, there were people trying to figure out how to save the chestnuts. And they knew that there were the Chinese chestnut trees that had been infected with the fungus but could still live. So they wanted to figure out, you know, could they maybe capture those genes through breeding? And you know, breed them into American chestnut trees and then breed out all the Chinese chestnut tree characteristics because the two trees look a little different. And then you'd have an American chestnut tree that was resistant, genetically resistant to the fungus. And so there was a 30-year breeding program that was developed by a couple of scientists, and it was taken over since it was a program that was intentionally 30 years. It was a whole long, you know, you breed one tree into another, then you breed another tree and a next generation and next generation. So it was a long-term program. So an organization called the American Chestnut Foundation sort of fostered, you know, took over this program and fostered the breeding of these trees. It's an amazing organization, involves lots of people, many, you know, and they started in the 80s, and the hope was that by now they would actually have a tree that was resistant to the chestnut blight, and that, you know, was mostly an American chestnut tree, so it had the big, tall, sort of, you know, certain kind of leaves characteristics. And what happened to do that kind of breeding back then when it started, the thinking was that there was just a gene or two that was responsible for resistance. And so it wouldn't be that difficult to, you know, kind of capture those genes through breeding. The reality is now that we have all this ability to do genetics, do it faster, cheaper, the sequencing of the resistant, that I think it was the Chinese trees that are resistant, found that there are actually a lot of genes that contribute to resistance and that are necessary for resistance. So, and they're distributed across different chromosomes. So the reality is that it would be really difficult to capture resistance. And the trees that they have now that were kind of the end of the breeding program that they thought would be resistant are not as resistant as they had hoped they would be. And they also don't have they still have more sort of Chinese chestnut tree characteristics than they would have hoped that they would have. So at the same time, there was another group in Syracuse, New York, that was working on developing a genetically engineered resistant chestnut tree. And the goal there was just to take a one gene that could provide resistance, which there is such a gene, and transfer that into the American chestnut tree. And that way you would have that tree that is fully American chestnut, but with just that resistance gene. And so that tree had actually been developed over those 30 years too. And it's just now going through all of the requirements and testing it's been through all the testing, and it's now going through the process of USDA, FDA, EPA, all the regulatory processes.
It seems, Emily, that a lot of the stories you're telling here lead to the conclusion that monoculture, growing just one kind of any sort of plant, is a bad idea. And yet, We have 8 billion people to feed, and, you know, these giant farms tend to be efficient. What do we do about this problem of, you know, just a couple species of wheat, one species of banana, lots of other plants that we expect to get the exact same thing every time we purchase them at the store?
Yeah, well, I think it's a huge problem. And I focus less on agriculture, I think, because it's such a big thing. I think you could write a whole book on that itself. I think the people that I did speak to who are in agriculture, some of them think you really, to feed all the mouths that we have to feed in the world, it's very difficult to get away from the current ways that we're growing food in large crops. But, you know, if we could grow crops that are more diverse, there's, you know, so as you mentioned, lots more different kinds of grains, which we are starting in on large scale. And we are starting to see that people are eating all different kinds of grains now that we didn't used to eat. Similarly with fruits, maybe bananas one day will be like the apples. We see so many different kinds of apples in the supermarket now. So there could be that you can grow more different kinds of that, you know, strains of the crop. There's agroforestry, which is just sort of changing how you grow and maybe interspersing other kinds of crops. And there's lots to agroforestry that I didn't go into, but again, it's another whole book and topic. But I think that there's some hope if we think about how we grow things differently, that hopefully we can get away from some of this.
Is there much progress in developing fungicides that could be applied to vulnerable plants without threatening other species that are not doing any harm?
That is a really good question. And I'm embarrassed to say that as someone trained as a toxicologist, I didn't spend a whole lot of time looking at the side of this issue from for fungicide as fungicides. So I do know that there are some people that are trying to develop fungicides that are, yes, less toxic, and also that are difficult for fungi to evolve resistance to. So that's even a bigger problem, is that a lot of the fungicides, just like any other pesticide we use, insecticides, herbicides, you know, the target species can evolve resistance. And so that's another issue with using fungicides, because then you have to use more and more and more as they do. So yeah, so I do think that there are efforts to try to develop fungicides that are less toxic. And also there are efforts to use the microbiome, so use a more natural system. Hmm. So whether that's using beneficial fungi that will help fend off pathogenic fungi or bacteria or other microbes. So there's a lot more attention to developing just healthy systems, whether it's, you know, in the soil, on plant leaves, wherever, so that maybe the, you know, you have a more sort of ecological strategy towards protecting your plants.
And there may be some secret hiding away in a seed bank somewhere, right? Some strain, kind of plant that is more resistant than the ones we commonly grow.
Yeah, so that was another really interesting part of the book when I was doing the research for this, was just to learn about the seed banks and the importance of the seeds, and also how narrow in terms of genetic diversity our crops are. They're very, you know, they're really not very genetically diverse, but there is a lot of genetic diversity, and saving that genetic diversity of our food plants is really important. And that's what these seed banks do. I think people who grow heritage plants know this, because that's why they've been doing it, and seed savers and all sorts of things. But, you know, saving those is something that's really important, because a lot of those do have natural resistances to some of these pests and pathogens. And so, yeah, by protecting those and learning how to grow those again, and maybe, you know, developing a taste for them, or whether it's that or breeding them with our current crops so that we can breed in resistance. So there would be all sorts of strategies with, you know, plants that have been sort of historically left behind from our agricultural system, but somebody has wisely saved those seeds.
You note at the very end of the book that preventing further degradation is our moral obligation. What are some ways that we can be part of the solution rather than just perpetuating the problem?
Yeah, so that is always, it's really hard when we think of, you know, a lot of things I spoke about are sort of regulations or a large scale for growers to do. And it's really hard to think of what individuals can do. But one of the things I would say is to su support the policymakers, to support the conservation agencies that are doing things to protect plants and animals and also ourselves. And also just to pay attention when you're traveling. It seems small, but there's a reason that airports ask you not to, customs ask you not to bring in those, you know, plants or the fruits that you brought from one country. So there's a reason why you don't do that. And part of it is so that you don't inadvertently bring the next kind of pathogen into the country.
Author Emily Monison is a member of the Ronan Institute for Independent Scholarship and an adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her book is called Blight, Fungi and the Coming Pandemic. Emily, this has been so interesting. Thank you for making time to talk.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can also get the podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. Find it by doing a search for KERA Think, or go to our website and listen there. That's think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.